Thank you for tuning in to Movie Geeks United. Tonight we speak with director and writer Daniel Ferrans and producer Tommy Hudson. Their new documentary is titled Crystal Lake Memories, The Complete History of Friday the 13th, an exhaustive examination that runs nearly 7 hours that explores every film in the Friday the 13th franchise in tremendous detail. The documentary is now available for purchase on DVD and Blu-ray. You can follow the link right here on our show page to purchase it for yourself.
While Elm Street is said to be located in the fictional town of Springwood, Ohio, Crystal Lake is approximately 600 miles away in rural New Jersey. Fans have asked, how were Lori and her friends able to get Jason back to Crystal Lake in record time?
Where is Crystal Lake located? That was a big problem for us in Freddy vs. Jason.
Because
we had to have to get them to be able to drive there.
But for us, it was important that it was far, like those two things. So we had all these scenes where they were going like all night and all day. And of course, you know, when the movie gets cut, it looks like they're like right next to each other.
I don't think that the idea of doing something of this scope was as daunting as it could have been had we not teamed up and done Never Sleep Again, The Elm Street Legacy, which was 4 hours long with 4 hours of bonus features. So I think we knew going in that this was going to be a big task, but we certainly had a very good idea of what we were getting into in terms of the actual production of the show. But in terms of all the genius behind the writing and directing, I'll turn it over to Dan.
Well, I don't know about that, but thank you very much. I mean, I don't think you can ever really be 100% prepared for a project this magnitude, but we, you know, like Tommy said, we'd worked together, you know, a number of times before on similar, you know, style shows. I mean, Elm Street being the biggest of those. And of course, you know, we knew, you know, how many Fridays there were. The other thing that I was kind of bringing to the table also was, you know, kind of a long history with the Friday the 13th franchise. I had produced the bonus features for the deluxe edition DVDs that Paramount released in about 2009, 2010. So I had that connection as well as, you know, for years before that, I was the editor of Peter Brackey's book on which this documentary is based. So, you know, all of the, you know, kind of research for this in a big way had been done. And Tommy and I also collaborated on another documentary called His Name Was Jason in 2008, if I get that correctly. And that one was more of kind of Jason-centric. I think we kind of approached that as kind of a, you know, this is who this character is, this is sort of how he fits into the pop culture and that sort of approach. But we had never really done, and nobody had ever really done something as extensive as what we did for Elm Street on the Friday the 13th series. So all of those things combined kind of, you know, those are the things that went into, let's do something with this, let's make it epic, let's make it, you know, kind of what the fans would really want to see. So that sort of was the genesis of it.
Well, what's amazing to me about the process of documentary filmmaking, no matter what your topic, it's always a process of discovery and refining, and you never know when your direction will change depending upon the material that you collect. So I'm wondering, in the process of putting this film together, what surprised you the most? What did you find that you weren't expecting to explore necessarily?
It's interesting. I don't know if there's anything like just groundbreaking that I discovered that we hadn't thought we would cover in this show. I think also because Peter's book covered so much ground. One person that we were able to interview that nobody had ever found, and this is full credit to Tommy, and Blake and Mikey, who were our production managers and did an amazing job of just getting as many people as we could interview into the show, and that numbered over 150. But there was one guy, it was a very interesting story, and it was something that had been alluded to in the book and other, you know, kind of retrospectives and stuff that had been done on this. But there was an actor from the 8th movie who was never known. Nobody knew his name. His name was Lee Coleman. But he was the only actor that we could ever find that was actually fired. He was the male lead of that film. And he was let go early on in the production for varying reasons. We'd heard, you know, that there was just very little chemistry between him and the female lead, Jensen. But everybody remembered that there was this guy, but nobody remembered his name. But somehow, some way, Tommy discovered him and found him and actually got him to agree to appear on camera. So that was an interesting kind of sideline that we weren't expecting to get. And it's interesting to hear somebody who was, you know, fired from one of these movies and what his recollections were.
Yeah, was there bitterness on his part, or was it all water under the bridge at this point?
I honestly think water under the bridge. I don't think if there's bitterness, he would have come on camera to talk about it. He was actually very nice and very gracious and, you know, really just kind of outlined, you know, his memories of, you know, why this all went down the way it did.
You know, getting people who have never spoken about the franchise, I think, informed Dan's ability to reach, you know, kind of a greater depth than maybe some things that, you know, even he, who knows almost everything about Friday the 13th, you know, could really delve into. Getting Dana Kimmel to really talk about it on camera, getting Jennifer Cook to talk about it. I think for the first time since she gave a couple quotes to Fangoria back in 86, she's never talked about it. So, you know, the surprises, I think, that came out and that really helped Dan do the most in-depth thing that he could regarding the writing and directing were simply that Lee Coleman, Jennifer Cook, Dana Kimmel, Frank Mancuso even, you know, they gave things that they don't normally talk about because they never get in-depth interviews, and Dan was able to pull that stuff out of them, which really, I think, makes the documentary just that much more in-depth and special and exclusive.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, we interviewed people here, like Tommy just mentioned, who've never kind of surfaced, you know, whether by choice or circumstance or whatever, but we managed to get so many of them to finally come forth and speak about, their time working on these films.
Well, and you speaking to so many participants, you know, 150 people, as you said, that have played various roles in this phenomenon that has thrived for so many years. Do they all feel that their participation in this series has been a blessing, or is it a curse to some of them in some way?
I think it's a little of all of it. You know, I think with some time there, I think there certainly comes some, you know, different perspectives on it. I think in that time period, you have to remember in the 80s when these movies were, you know, at the height of this series when it was being made, I mean, these movies were critically just eviscerated. There were all kinds of groups, including the MPAA, that were just out to kind of, you know, decimate the movies and ensure that, you know, they really felt like, you know, there was that sort of faction that said, you know, these movies are the downfall of society and they've got to go. And they blamed everything on, you know, it was a scapegoat, in other words. I think movies of this genre, particularly Friday the 13th, because it was distributed by a major studio, Paramount, you know, there was a kind of a stigma to it. So I think, you know, Frank is one who talked about that, and there certainly was a stigma to it over a period of time, and he couldn't keep going on with that. So that's why he kind of chose to break away from it. But that being said, he has a great fondness for the fans and for what the films have come to mean to so many people, and it was just great to hear from him.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, some of the actors, too, certainly, I mean, the thing is, it's like, and this is not something that was necessarily revealed to us, but I do remember, you know, some of the actors, particularly the final girls, talking in interviews in Fangoria, you know, some of them looked back on it and thought, you know, hey, what can you do? You have a guy coming at you with a chainsaw or an axe or this, and I've never been chased by an axe-wielding maniac before, so I hit my mark, I showed up on time. I think a lot of people do kind of look back, and if it didn't help their career, then, you know, I don't know if there's bitterness, but there's certainly kind of a what else could I have done attitude, and they kind of, you know, move on with their lives, as opposed to the people who embrace it. And so I don't think there's anything necessarily negative. I think some people embrace it more than others. And some people look back on it as a tiny piece of their history. It was just another job, and it didn't maybe lead to anything greater or grander, but it certainly might not have destroyed their career either. So it's just maybe a piece of history for them.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting, too. Some people, I think, are a little bit, you know, like, wow, you know, that people are even, I think some are fascinated by the fact that people are interested in hearing what they have to say. You know, some people think, like, well, why would anybody care what I have to say about these movies? And I think some don't, even to this day, realize what, you know, a cult following this series has.
Exactly. And if you're a rabid fan, which obviously your documentary has been made with a tremendous amount of love and affection for the series. I mean, you have something like 7 hours of material you've collected here.
Yeah.
I mean, you want every morsel you could get. And that's what you're presenting in the documentary.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting because last week I was doing an interview about Mario Bava, and we talked about a film of his called The Bay of Blood. And a lot of the tenets of Friday the 13th's premise are there in A Bay of Blood. Was that one of the inspirations for Friday the 13th?
Well, you know, we cover that a little bit in the documentary. I mean, you know, the people who made the Friday the 13th films, let's put it this way, there were people involved in those early films who certainly had access to Bava's, you know, early efforts, that film in particular. In fact, I think the distributors of that film, at least in the U.S., were some of the financiers involved in Friday the 13th. That being said, and one of them who's passed on, a guy named Phil Scuderi, he kind of was always seen as the architect of the series. He was kind of the mastermind behind it, never took credit, never really stepped out and said, hey, you know, these were all my ideas. He never wrote them. He would always hire a writer, but he was kind of the guy with those sort of ideas in his head of, oh, what if we killed a guy in a wheelchair and shoved a machete in his head and had him go backwards down the stairs? I mean, he's the guy that conceived of all these creative, crazy set pieces and these murders. The one that always comes to mind, and I think that people kind of point to, is the so-called shish kebab kill in number two. You know, Sean Cunningham, who made the first film, he has no memory of ever having seen Bay of Blood or Twitch of the Death Nerve. Never remember seeing it, hearing about that movie, but it's highly possible that Phil Scuderi knew of it and said, let's use that. Let's shish kebab this couple. Because again, Phil was the guy who was kind of inventing these death scenes, you know, and would, in fact, Ron Kurz, who wrote the second film and he also did an uncredited rewrite on the first one, you know, he said he was embarrassing because Phil would get up in restaurants and start acting out these sequences. Like, yeah, this is what I want you to write, you know. Yeah.
Speaking of which, do you guys have a favorite kill from the series?
I mean, there's so many of them at this point, but, you know, I mean, you could probably, you know, boil it down to some of the, you know, probably ones that everybody else loves. I think the sleeping bag kill in number seven is a kind of a classic that everybody remembers. But I even go back to the first one, how inventive it was with Kevin Bacon being killed on the bed like that. That was such a magic trick that nobody had ever seen before. I mean, really, at the time, you had to wonder how they did it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, is it Jason X, the one where he freezes the head and then shatters it against the table? I like
that.
Yeah,
the liquid nitrogen. Yeah, that's very clever, very creative.
So this interests me too, because when a film becomes so incredibly successful and it warrants this many sequels, I mean, there's obviously a formula that people crave. So what, in your estimation, were the results when they tried to veer too far from that?
Yeah, there's a formula. You know, it's like Randy and Scream. There's a formula, a very formula.
Yep.
However, there are now 12 movies, and I really don't know many franchises. Even if you're looking at, like, the Bond franchise, yeah, the formula is there. There's a lot of action, and there's a girl. But you really have to take the story in different places to keep it fresh. Otherwise, you are truly remaking the same movie over and over again. And I think, how many movies could they have made where it was just kids at a camp before it really became the same movie, particularly because these are low-budget productions. These are not, you know, $60, $70 million, $100 million movies where they can do incredibly elaborate things and make everything so extravagant and amazing. You know, I like Jason X. I think it's a fun movie. I think it's hilarious that they took Jason into space, and, you know, I think it's a lot of different things like that. Friday the 13th Part 7, which is one of my favorites in the franchise, as I love to point out, Dan knows so well.
Yes, he does.
Listen, Carrie versus Jason. I mean, yeah, it's kids in the woods, but they have to do something else. And
right. I think I have to say, Gary, I mean, really, I mean, when, you know, 7 isn't my favorite in the series, but what I like about it is that John Deakler and the people who made that film, they really tried to do something else. They injected some new element into the formula to make it just a slightly different movie. And I thought it was very clever and creative, and they pulled off a lot of amazing mechanical effects in that movie, which today would all be done with CG, but back then, you know, all the TV flying across that room had to be done, you know, for real. You know, they had to really pull that stuff off with, you know, wires. And a lot of mechanical stunts and things that you just hadn't seen in a Friday the 13th film. And I think that was an ingenious sort of way to approach a new Jason film. He'd never really met a real foe, you know, somebody who could kind of, you know, not only beat him physically, but, you know, using the power of the mind. I thought that was really smart, really cool.
And the other thing is, in terms of, like, changing up the formula, you know, obviously 1 and 2 are very similar. You know, part 3 could be seen as a change in formula because they weren't really campers, and it really didn't feel like they were at camp or Camp Crystal Lake. And then you have the gimmick of 3D, which, you know, that movie did very well for them. Part 4, kind of similar, you know, in terms of not necessarily being a camp, but then you introduce, you know, the young boy, Tommy Jarvis, who essentially becomes, and, you know, I know we've talked about this with other people, kind of the Greek chorus. He's the fan. He's us watching the movie. And then you have 5, which, I mean, it went off the rails. Okay.
Yes.
But then you have 6.
But it has its fans, we got to say. I mean, that's one thing, too. I'm just interjecting real quick, but I mean, with, you know, like, that's one thing that we did always have in mind, you know.
It would be very easy to shortchange a movie like 5 or even Jason X or Jason Goes to Hell, you know, maybe some of the lesser ones, you know, in the series. But, you know, all of those have their fans. I mean, Luke Rapalowski, who is one of our editors, is one of the biggest Part 5 fans on the planet. And I was like, you know, each one of these has its fan base, and we have to kind of treat each one with the same level of kind of attention and to detail that we gave the other films that might be more popular. So we did that. I mean, not every segment is as in-depth as all the rest, but certainly every movie gets its due, and I think we tell the complete story of each one. So that was something that always we kept in mind, you know, going through the process of this, was making sure that we, you know, weren't really, you know, necessarily judging the film. We don't judge them, but certainly the people involved in them, and it's interesting to hear how they look back in terms of the, you know, the quality or the reception that these movies had.
Sure. Just one more question for you guys, and then I'll let you go. I want to know your take on what the ultimate legacy of this franchise has been, because, I mean, I know that it's informed the genre around it a great deal over the years. So what's your take on that?
Look, I mean, I don't think there would be Saws and Hostels and, you know, any of these other modern franchises that have come today if it weren't for Friday the 13th. It was really, even more so than Halloween, which, you know, is near and dear to me in many ways as well, but, you know, Halloween was a psychological, more of a thrill ride, a thriller. You know, Friday the 13th took it an extra step, and they took those murders, those graphic murders, and put them right in your face. So that really opened up the floodgates to this sort of whole new, you know, kind of approach to modern horror. And I think you really have to credit Friday the 13th with kind of introducing that to the world. See, I think it'll always be, look, I mean, Jason has become a modern icon and a modern myth of Boogeyman for our age. And I think he'll remain that way for a while. I don't think he's going anywhere anytime soon. And
That's the thing. The legacy will live on. I mean, they're talking now about another sequel to the 2009 film. I mean, you know, even if there wasn't another movie, hockey masks are probably going to be associated with Jason Voorhees for a lot longer than they will a goalie in a hockey game.
Yeah, and that's
part of the power of this character and this franchise, you know, the little movie that could, you know, spawned 11 sequels and continues, you know, look, we're looking at it and we're talking about it 30 years later. So I think the legacy, you know, is powerful and it will probably live on longer than any of us.
There are many words for making a movie again. I think retelling is a fashionable one right now.
Definitely not a reimagining, because we are just basically going back to what Jason was in the first place.
It could have been called a sequel, in my opinion.
A mashup or a poo-poo platter.
More of a hybrid.
It was a reboot.
A reintroduction.
A potpourri.
A greatest hit.
But I don't even really know what it is.
From the get-go, for me, it was always, this is a reboot, and that was sort of drilled into our heads.
It's a re-box office-ing. That's what it is.
It's sort of the Reader's Digest of slasher films.